Welcome to The Wrap-Up, a weekly podcast that gives you an insider's look at the top stories in Hollywood. I'm your host, Sharon Waxman, the founder and editor-in-chief of The Wrap. Joining me is my co-host, Lawrence Yee, our assistant managing editor. Hey, Lawrence.
Hey, Sharon. So we talked about the IATSE strike and Chappelle's special last week. Yep. And the stories have only gotten bigger, so we're revisiting them.
Yep, for sure. Hollywood is on the verge of a shutdown with IATSE's strike deadline looming on Monday, so just in a few days, and with the strike authorization vote already passed. And there is more fallout, both internally and externally, from Dave Chappelle's Netflix comedy special in which he takes on the trans community. The CEO of Netflix, Ted Sarandos, has stated his opinion, which is to keep the show up and support Chappelle's right to his point of view, to his artistic freedom, but not all of his employees agree. We will talk about that. Later in the show, you're going to get to hear my conversation with top Hollywood dealmakers, Kevin Mayer, Tom Staggs, Faiza Said, and Jeff Sagansky from our Grill event, and we'll be discussing this new era of Hollywood mega mergers and SPACs.
Yeah, that was a really great conversation. It seems like many corporations nowadays need to acquire or die. But first, let's get to the week's top headlines. As you mentioned, contract negotiations continue between IATSE, the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, and studios this week. Among their asks, higher wages, dedicated meal breaks, and longer turnaround times between shifts and on weekends. But IATSE's leadership has now drawn a line in the sand with its 60,000 plus members poised to go on strike at midnight next Monday if a deal is not reached. That'll really paralyze Hollywood. We welcome in The Wrap's film reporter, Jeremy Fuster, who has been monitoring the discussions to the podcast. Jeremy, if IATSE goes on strike next week, what productions will be affected?
Well, the answer is almost everything. Almost all film, television productions, and streaming productions would be shut down immediately. This would, because IATSE covers below-the-line workers in everything you can name, like hair, makeup, set design, lighting technicians, cinematographers, film editors, sound editors, all of that. It covers all of those positions. And it would also impact some productions that are happening overseas that Hollywood studios are doing. A lot of times they go over to London or to Europe or other places to shoot on location. And even though those productions sometimes hire local talent that aren't unionized by IATSE, they still hire department heads in all those different categories that I mentioned that are all unionized by IATSE. The costume designer is almost always IATSE. The cinematographer, almost always IATSE. So it's going to shut down pretty much everything. And honestly, the bigger question is what it doesn't cover.
Yeah, I think that I read in your story that pay cable is exempt for whatever reason, but everything but that. But it really is going to impact not just sort of the internal industry if this happens, God forbid. I say that on behalf of everybody, but also, you know, just a basic viewer, you know, the American public that is not going to be able to have the television shows that they're used to having air, you know, certainly anything that's live, like Dancing with the Stars. Lawrence, you and I were talking about that show.
Yeah, late night will also be affected. Is that
late
right?
Late night.
Yeah.
Saturday
This isn't going to be like the writer's strike, where with the writer's strike, you saw the late night shows. They were still going. They just had no writers. And the hosts noted that they had no writers. But without the people behind the cameras, you can't even get them rolling.
Right.
Yeah. So this is going to, I mean, the American public is going to feel it and feel it right away. I mean, I'm talking about it like it's still going to happen. For me, Jeremy, it's like I can hardly get my head around the industry coming to a standstill months, not even a year after COVID has, first of all, shut everything down and then continued to sort of hamper normal production. I it's real hard for me to get my head around, but talking to you and reading your coverage, it feels like it really could happen.
Yeah, and it's funny that we talk about this happening just months after the pandemic. Really, I think it really is the pandemic that led to this, because it from all my talks with IATSE members, it just really led them to take stock of what it is they're doing, you know, what they accept as a status quo and how much they get paid for it. I think a lot of them I've spoken to, they talked about how they were all at home. They were all watching Netflix and Amazon. They were seeing these industry headlines about how Netflix was just making untold millions from the pandemic. And there are writer's assistants and script coordinators who have been working in the industry for upwards of 10 years, and they're still making $16, $17 an hour in Los Angeles. That's barely enough to pay the rent. Some of them even live out of their cars. And then there's also just the working conditions, where I've talked with cinematographers and set designers and makeup artists who have to work like 14, 15 hours sometimes for several days and often into the weekends. And there's just this physical and mental burnout. And the
pandemic. Yeah, but on the other hand, you can talk to producers, and we just had a producers panel at the Grill like barely a week ago or a week and a half ago, and they're talking about how their margins are so squeezed, how the costs of production have gone up for them, and so Netflix subscriber numbers, for sure, they took a yet another turn for upward during COVID, but from what I hear from producers, like, the cost of these productions have just gone up by, on average, 15-20% for them. So I'm not weighing it either way. And absolutely, we should be living in their cars to be working in this industry. That's really dismaying to know that that's the case for some people. That seems to be the other side of the argument that I'm hearing.
Yeah. And I think the question everybody's been asking, both within the industry and my friends and family, like, is there really going to be a strike, or are they going to strike some sort of 11th hour deal on Sunday night? And my impression, and admittedly, they are having a huge media blackout and there's very little getting out of the negotiating room. But the sense that I get is it depends on what the sticking point is on these talks. You know, with these bargaining agreements, you're always talking about the phrase wages and working conditions. If the sticking point is the wages, I could see them reaching some sort of 11th hour deal. There can be compromises on wages, and maybe the membership may not like what they see with those wages, but in the negotiating room, there can be compromises, and then they will send it to the membership to ratify the contract, and we'll see if the membership is good with that. But the working conditions, that is, by all accounts, both from the memos that we've seen from IATSE leadership and from the rank and file, that is the hard line. That is where they're putting their foot down on all of this.
And then you're talking about meal breaks, or you're talking about having downtime between productions. That's what we're talking about.
The phrase the members are using is reasonable rest. That is something they very seriously want. They want, I'm hearing at least a 12-hour turnaround, which means that shooting days can't last longer than 12 hours. They want these lunch breaks, that they want a serious change to how film and TV shows are produced and what the daily life is on these sets, to bring a change to this burnout that's been going through the entire industry. If that is the sticking point, then I think we're definitely going to be going to a strike, because there is just so much momentum behind the organizing on this issue that the members are just not going to accept any less. And the negotiating committee knows this.
Yeah, definitely something that we'll have to keep an eye out for. And certainly we might know in the next couple of hours, or certainly by this deadline, but Hollywood is on pins and needles, very much so, because these are,
again, I don't think but Lawrence, they always take down to the wire. Like, they never, they're not going to break it 6 o'clock on Friday. Oh, we decided, it's going to be like midnight 01, on Sunday.
But yeah, Jeremy brings up a really good point about the conditions versus the wages. The wages seems to be something more executable easily, whereas the conditions are varied and they obviously need a lot of thought into execution and the more complicated, I guess, of the agenda items.
Well, before we let Jeremy go, I mean, what strikes me also is not just that this perhaps is a result of COVID and, the working people of Hollywood looking around and seeing who the winners are and wanting to participate in that. But it might also be related, I'd like, you know, be curious your view, Jeremy, on this, of this sort of content overload and all of these streamers needing so much content to feed all of these streaming services that have launched in the past year, and that there's this sort of pitched competition to have the best content and the most content and the biggest variety of content. And, you know, maybe that there's also that pressure that's driving producers to kind of get stuff done more faster and squeeze as much out of their people as they possibly can to finish the project, get on to the next?
Yes, I think that that's definitely a factor in it. I wrote a couple of weeks ago for the Wrap Pro, I wrote a story about how the, not just IATSE members, but the Writers Guild, Directors Guild, yeah, SAG-AFTRA members, they're all very looking very closely at this,
right?
Because this new status quo of this just overwhelming demand for new streaming titles to fill up all these streamers, it's creating a whole new frontier. And the WGA members all remember back in 2007 when they got rolled basically on the on residuals for streaming shows, because it was seen as this new thing. No one knew how it was going to play out. Right. But now, right, you know, last year was supposed to be the big showdown between Hollywood labor and the studios on figuring out what this new frontier was going to look like and how much people are going to be paid for all these shows that are being produced, and what it's going to look like being paid for and creating all these streaming shows. Then COVID hit and it was sort of, okay, we will table this, but it's coming when the next round of contracts come in 2023. And this IATSE situation is being seen as a precursor for what is to come there. So definitely the whole new kaleidoscope, a whole constellation of streaming services is hanging low over what is going on with these talks.
Yeah. Well, I would just want to recommend to our listeners that they follow Jeremy's coverage of this, because it's really been excellent. And Jeremy, you're really very close to these issues and have done, I think, really superb coverage. And I know you'll continue to do that. So definitely follow Jeremy Fuster. He's on therap.com. You can find him there. Thanks, Jeremy.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Yep.
Shifting gears, fallout continues from Dave Chappelle's Netflix special, The Closer, internally and externally. In a company memo this week, CEO Ted Sarandos defended Chappelle's jokes, which groups like GLAAD and the HRC have deemed transphobic. He wrote, quote, "We know that a number of you have been left angry, disappointed, and hurt by our decision to put Chappelle's latest special on Netflix." That's what he was telling the employees. Continued with the quote, "While some employees disagree, we have a strong belief that content on screen doesn't directly translate to real-world harm," end quote. Now, there's been a group of trans Netflix employees and their allies that have been quite vocal on social media in disagreement, saying that they do think that these types of messages do cause harm to the trans community. And to that end, they're actually striking next week and planning a walkout. Now, I don't know how many these trans employees and their allies number, but clearly there's some internal dissent within Netflix, and not everybody is buying the company line or falling in behind what Sarandos is saying.
Yeah. I mean, I have so many thoughts about this.
Yeah.
It's because it's just a really multi-layered and complicated issue. One of the things that I think I'm going to say this in Ted's defense, that sentence, because I read that sentence and I rolled my eyes and I thought, oh, Ted, like, why would you say that? We all know that words matter, and that, you know, coming off of where we just had an insurrection right, at the Capitol in the wake of an incendiary speech by our then president, how could you say a thing like that? And then I went back and I read the whole thing and I thought that in context, I don't think it was the best advised thing to say, but what he was, the point he'd been trying to make was that Netflix, and he said this in his first statement, which I thought was a better statement, which was, he said, "We don't tolerate hate or hate speech or speech that leads to violence, but it is not our, our judgment is that this does not rise to that level." And I think reasonable people can disagree about what is the kind of speech that can lead to violence or, you know, and bad actions. I think every reasonable person will agree that certain kinds of speech will lead to violence and that those kinds of speech should be restricted or limited or barred. Hate speech is even on Facebook, which I inveigh against all the time, right, bars hate speech. So I feel like if you read it in context, you sort of see the point he was trying to make, which was basically trying to say that, what we were discussing, I was discussing earlier, we've been discussing this so much internally because there's a lot to try to understand. I'm like, what is the right response here for Netflix, not for us. Thank goodness it's not a decision. It's not our decision to make, but what is the right thing to do? It's always easy to say, we'll take it down. But then the question is, what's the cost? What do you give up when you tell Dave Chappelle, no, people are offended by what you say and they think it will lead to violence. Yeah. So this whole argument of like, for example, if you take this was the comparison he was using, and I don't know if it's apt or not, but there used to be a conversation about whether violent movies led to violence among children in real life. And Hollywood kind of won that argument, right? We still have very violent movies. We still have shooter video games, and the government has not legislated against it. You know, sadly, we still have an insane amount of gun violence in this country, but in countries where there are gun laws that shows the same movies and play the same violent video games, they do not have the kind of violence. So that was always an argument Hollywood made. And I think that he was trying to rely on that. It was kind of a misfire, in my opinion. Yeah. But to me, the core question comes back to like, where is the line? Where's the line, right?
And it's very difficult. We talked about the sharing quite a bit. It's very difficult for a company of Netflix's scale, right?
Because
we're talking about a company that it's not just a comedy provider, right? If it was Comedy Central and only did, you know, jokes and this type of platform, you know, it would be one thing. But the fact that they do documentary, the fact that they do theatrical, the fact that they do a lot of content that can be, you know, considered controversial, certainly they had a controversy last year with that movie Cuties, which was a foreign film, that had some issues with, you know, the depictions of children, kind of graphic, sexually graphic.
The complaint was that it sexualized adolescent girls, but the movie, if you watched it, which I'm sure most of the people who criticized it never bothered to watch it because it became a political football. Very clearly, the Maimouna Doucouré, who we know here at The Wrap, and who was part of our shorts early on, or when she did the early version of something in the same vein or with the same community, was actually making a statement against sexualizing pre-adolescent girls. That was indeed her point. So anyway, but you can disagree. That's the nature of art.
Yeah. And what do you think about the employees, though? Because Netflix has always prided itself and certainly is well known for what they call their very honest culture, right? They encourage like 360 feedback on all their employee reviews. It is a culture that they welcome, you know, dissent and differing opinions, but it's really been heightened in the last couple of days with these social media accounts that are quite, you know, vocal and, you know, active in sort of saying like, we really disagree with what's going on.
Yeah.
And we disagree with what the CEO has said and put out there. And they're going to put it into action by March.
I mean, that's sort of the pattern, right? I saw it on like, I don't know if it was Sunday night or something. I saw this thread by the trans person who works at Netflix.
Yeah. Tara Field. She's an engineer. Yeah.
Tara, is that it?
Yeah. Tara Field.
Yeah. Right. Somebody didn't know. I saw somebody's retweet of it and I thought, wow, here's somebody who works at Netflix who's going way out on a limb and I hadn't watched the special either. So it was all very out of context for me. And then the response, rather than appeasing or mollifying people who oppose Dave Chappelle, it really just fed it. And it's gotten more and more sort of entrenched. Now people really feel invested in this one demand that this come down.
Yeah.
I think it's a very, and especially with this last statement that Ted Sarandos made, I think that he's put himself more in a corner. So he's going to have to figure out how to get past that. I also think this is an issue that companies are dealing with more and more when you have employees who will go out and make statements out of school, and put their name on it. We had that recently with the New Yorker, the archivist for the New Yorker, called out the New Yorker for a lack of diversity in over many decades and gave chapter and verse on it, like gave statistics on the masthead and on the writers. That is what is happening in this day and age. And as to how many people, I think it will be really indicative to see how Netflix needs to deal with this when we see how this walkout goes next week, because Ted has kind of drawn a line in the sand saying he will not take the special down. And so I think that is, it's challenging. Yeah. And I think your point about the scale of Netflix is really important. Like, how do you serve so many different constituencies when you are trying to be the sort of the cultural, the machine that creates cultural, you know, cultural content, entertainment, really for the entire world, and not just different communities like right wing, left wing, men, old men, young girls, you know, all of that, but also for all around the world, literally be a global entertainment machine. I think that is holding that in balance, you know, in tension, is going to be quite a challenge for them going forward.
Yeah, there's definitely going to be a lot of conversations internally, and you know, we'll have to see. But it's, again, something we'll be keeping an eye on. Definitely come back to The Wrap to see our continued coverage of, you know, what's going to happen with Chappelle and obviously Netflix as a whole.
Yeah, very, very tough topic, very rich topic, and an important one.
Yeah. Finally, Sharon's favorite show is back. And to celebrate, we have a new segment called Succession Obsession. Try saying that 10 times fast. The only thing that I know about the show is that there's a character named Lawrence Yee who is not based on me. So we brought on two Succession superfans this week, Zoe Hazen and Ben Spetke, to preview the new season with Sharon. Take it away, everyone.
All right. Thank you guys for coming on, because I hate to sit here and just inveigh by myself about this Shakespearean drama that we have going on. All right, so where we left things last season, everybody knows this isn't, there's nothing spoilery at all, is that Kendall Logan shocked the world when he was supposed to take the fall for his dad and go to jail for various, I don't know, corruption and other shady dealings at the company. And instead, he turned the tables and said that he was going to rat out his dad, Logan Roy. So I have seen the first two episodes, and I can tell you they're really good. So let me start with you. What are you most looking forward to this season?
Well, I mean, we already saw a glimpse at Logan's reaction to that. And it honestly, it didn't really surprise me, but we saw him kind of realize that maybe Kendall is a bit of a killer. And I think that it's going to be, I'm personally really looking forward to seeing how that plays out in his relationships with his other kids, because I feel like Kendall has kind of taken the fall for a lot of his dad's anger. And I guess we'll see what happens. Like, who's the next on the chopping block?
Yeah. Well, having seen the first episode, I can tell you that there's this fantastic kind of chess game being played, without giving anything away to people who haven't seen it yet, between Kendall and Logan, as he's and as the other three children try to figure out who they should side with. So the whole first episode is about everybody playing both sides against the middle and trying to figure out who's more likely to prevail. So, and of course, no morals, principles, or actual affection is involved. This is purely, you know, power politics. Ben, what
right,
is
we've
it?
Never seen, we've never seen that before on this show.
Totally, exactly. Well, yeah, but it's like really wound super tight because the stakes are so high. Like, Ben, I did not know until recently that you were a super fan of the show. Why do you like it so much, and what are you looking forward to?
Well, I mean, it's one of those shows where it's really hard to find a character to like. It kind of, it becomes like a thing where you're just enjoying not liking them. And I think the one that I disliked the most is probably Roman. Cause I just think he's such an entertaining sort of,
right.
Awful
Roman
person.
Played. Roman is the youngest who's kind of got
Kieran
the young.
Culkin. Yeah.
Yeah. Kieran Culkin has like a complex of being the youngest. Yeah. And he has a big mommy infatuation with the top female executive.
Right. Who's actually supposed to be the actress who plays that executive is actually a really close friend of his.
Really? Real life?
Yeah. So okay. It's kind of interesting that they're playing that flirtation thing on the show. You know, it's just a fun world to sort of inhabit. And I have to be honest, I haven't seen the first episodes of the new season, and I'm kind of forgetting a lot of what the plot points of the last season, because it's been a while. So it's going to be, I'm looking forward to sort of catching up with what's been going on. One thing that's always puzzled me going back to first season was that, the patriarch of this family, if you remember, was really sick, and there was a whole thing about his mental health, and he's in a hospital bed in his penthouse. Mm-hmm. And then they just drop that whole thing, and he's fine as can be. So I'm wondering if that is ever going to come back, or was that just a false start in the narrative when they first
launched? That's a good question. Another thing that is totally absent is COVID is like no trace so far this season, from what I've seen, of a global pandemic, either, you know, or a stolen or a near stolen election for that matter. It's all happening in a parallel universe. But so who's your favorite character on Succession?
My friend had watched Succession in full before I watched it. And she was like, you're going to love Roman. Like, I'm not going to give you any details, but like, he's going to be your favorite character and you're going to lead his fan club probably. And literally just because of his little one-liners alone, she was absolutely right. Like, he's the most entertaining character, like Ben said. Right. And also just like, he revels in chaos. And maybe it's a red flag that I think he's great, but like, out of the people in the family, he's probably the only one that I would get a drink with. I, on the flip side, am the president of the Kendall Hate Club. Like, I really don't like Kendall. I'm sorry.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I can't pull myself out of it because I got to interview Jeremy Strong last year for the Emmys.
He's incredible.
And as an actor, he's so unbelievable. And he was up for the Emmy for Best Actor in the drama category against Logan Roy. Brian, somebody help me with his last name. Brian Cox, thank you, who is a monster actor, like really. Yeah. And he comes out of, and Brian Cox, of course, comes out of the British tradition of great stage actors. So I would think that any American actor would like be trembling in their boots to go up against him. And I think he was. There's a really amazing moment where he describes kind of how, the two of them went head to head. It's in the scene right before he rats him out before the end of the season. And I think it's what won him the Emmy, but where he has to just, he said they did one take of this where he tells him, you are going to jail and you just see where Kendall goes. I mean, I could see why you think Kendall is like a two-faced snake with a, substance problem that he, and the way he treats women is completely unacceptable. But what's interesting is in season one, the first episode of the new season three, is that he is donning the mantle of the representative of truth and justice, which is, of course, hilarious because he's using that because it works for him as a power play. But that is the persona that he's adopting, is the one person who's willing to tell the truth and the one person who's willing to let it all be open and transparent and just let the chips fall where they may. Of course, the chips would send his dad to prison. So,
I mean, I'm open to changing my mind if this season.
He's not a hero.
I don't think anybody is. And I think Ben makes a really good point right. with that, because it's really hard to like anybody, even Greg sometimes.
Is Greg like?
Greg is like, like if it were Shakespeare, Greg would be the court jester, right? Like who's in Macbeth. And I don't actually know which Shakespearean play Succession reminds me like the most of. I'd have to reread my Shakespeare probably, but everything about it feels Shakespearean to me.
It feels like I Claudius to me, but without Claudius. Like everybody in that show.
Oh, I Claudius was fantastic all the way back. Who that was? Lawrence, the great British stage actors. That was I Claudius, right? That's who that was. So, all right. Well, thank you guys. We will reconvene in the future time, where we will be able to actually discuss the current episodes. Ben, you might want to rewatch the last episode. I would highly recommend just rewatch the last episode of last season, because it has been a really long time.
I'll catch on pretty quick. I mean, you know, I'm not worried about it.
Yeah, but it has been, because of COVID, they basically lost not quite a year, but it feels like a year, but it's less than a year, but they lost a lot of time. They couldn't shoot it. And, but it's like, to me, it felt like, you know, getting back in a warm bath, you know, just like putting the characters, you know, back in your psyche. And, it's such a great cast of characters. You guys will love it. We will reconvene and you'll let us know what you think of the first 1, 2, 3 episodes.
Yeah. And the season 3 premiere of Succession, of course, drops this Sunday on HBO and HBO Max. And we'll have a lot of great kind of input throughout the season on the rest of the wrap up. So thank you, right. Zoe and Ben.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Now for a segment we call Wax On, Wax Off, where Sharon gives her thoughts on some other Hollywood happenings. Sharon, who is your wax on this week?
Well, I gave it up for Succession, since we've already said it's my favorite show on TV. I wouldn't want to say that. I'm not sure I would have said that myself, but it is definitely one of my very favorite shows on TV. And I'm excited that it's coming back. And I'm here to tell you guys, having seen the first 2 episodes, that it is really worth waiting for. All your favorite venal and sinister and completely without morals and ethics characters are all back, and they are all at each other's throats. So if you want a break from the real world, which has not been easy for the past year and a half, and if you're tired of Ted Lasso happiness, Succession is here for you. That's my wax on. My wax off is, please let's not have a strike, people. Can we just not? I mean, I've been watching, and we've been chronicling here at The Wrap over the past year and a half, all of the pain and suffering that has been the state of the entertainment industry for the past year and a half. People having to cancel jobs, people losing jobs, all of the ripple effects on all of the related economic actors, and whether it's caterers and dry cleaners or, you know, hotels and all the things that drive the whole ecosystem in the city of Los Angeles and beyond, wherever entertainment happens, the last thing we need is another strike. Yeah. So I am not weighing in one way or the other. We always want better working conditions for people in the guild, and we understand that, you know, the producers are always going to try to protect whatever they can in terms of their business model and their profit margins, and all of that is under strain. But I just don't see how this is going to be a win for this industry overall if where we end up on Monday is a strike. So folks, work it out, please. That's my wax off.
Yeah, work it out. Well, that does it for this week's Wax On, Wax Off. When we come back, our panel on mergers and acquisitions from The Grill with Kevin Mayer, Tom Staggs, Faiza Saeed, and Jeff Sagansky.
Hi there, and welcome to The Grill Conversation, Acquire or Die, navigating the era of mergers and SPACs, presented by Gerber Kawasaki. For the past couple of years, consolidation has been the name of the game in Hollywood. After Viacom and CBS re-merged, after AT&T shocked everybody by backing a Discovery Warner Brothers merger, after Amazon bought MGM, are we done? And what about all of these SPACs, these special purpose acquisition companies? With us today are the leading experts in this field. Kevin Mayer and Tom Staggs are the co-CEOs and co-chairs of the SPAC Forest Road Acquisition Corp. Kevin is the former TikTok CEO and was the head of strategy and then direct-to-consumer at Disney. He was recently named the chairman of the Daisen Group. Tom Staggs is a former COO and CFO of Disney, and he is now a Spotify board member. They continue to serve as senior advisors to their first SPAC, which acquired the digital fitness brand Beachbody in February and has gone public. Most recently, they've been in the headlines for leading the acquisition of Reese Witherspoon's Hello Sunshine for a valuation of $900 million as part of their unnamed media venture in which they serve as co-CEOs backed by Blackstone. Over the past 10 years, Jeff Sagansky and his partner, Harry Sloan, have founded seven special purpose acquisition companies, which acquired and took public companies, including DraftKings, Skillz, a video game competition platform, William Scotsman, America's largest modular office space leasing company, and Videocon DTH, which is India's fastest growing direct-to-home pay TV provider. His latest SPAC, Soaring Eagle, IPO'd in March 2021, raising $1.7 billion. Welcome to Jeff. Faiza Saeed is the presiding partner at Cravath, Swain & Moore. She advises on mergers and acquisitions and is widely recognized within the entertainment industry as a go-to advisor. Her clients include Disney, Viacom, Time Warner, Hasbro, DreamWorks, and Amblin. That kind of sounds like everybody in our space. He's also a trustee of the Paley Center and New York Presbyterian and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. So welcome to you guys. Took a minute to read all those big bios because you're so accomplished, all of you. And you guys do know each other from the space. Let me just start by throwing out a question because we've been through this massive period of consolidation. Is that period over, or are we still, do you think, in a period of ongoing further consolidation? Anybody can jump in. Jeff, I'm going to start with you.
Okay. I think this is only the beginning for two reasons. One, you've got massive liquidity in the system. Fed's still printing money every month. Borrowing rates, corporate borrowing rates at an all-time low. Mm-hmm. Corporate cash on the balance sheets at an all-time high. And then you've got dry powder in the, you know, these PE firms that on a worldwide basis, last thing I read was they've got $2.5 trillion to invest. And then you've got the stock market at an all-time high because of liquidity. So that, I think, is driving incredible stock market returns and a lot of the M&A. And the other thing that's driving it is we're at an inflection point, you know, for all the legacy media companies where they basically have to, you know, take their incredibly profitable core business, their cable business, 40% margins and go direct to the consumer. And that is a really expensive, difficult thing to do. It requires a lot of focus. And so we're going to continue to see massive consolidation and M&A around all of these issues.
Well, at some point, don't we run out of companies to consolidate? Seriously.
No, I don't think we do, because it's going to be all about the bundle. The bundle is going to be more than video. It's going to be audio. It's going to be games. It's going to be casual games. It may be gambling. So all of these things are going to be consolidated on one platform where there's, you know, where the consumer is paramount and where we're selling the consumer a much enhanced bundle.
Kevin, Tom, Faiza, do you guys agree with Jeff?
I think there has to be an end to M&A. I mean, you know, these things are accordions. Things come together and there's a lot of scale. Then sometimes they go back to, you know, breaking apart a little bit. But I think basically Jeff's right. There are enormous forces, economic forces, that are causing this to happen. On the legacy media side, certainly scale becomes important. The direct-to-consumer shift is real and is underway in a substantial way. That does create need for scale. It creates need for new capabilities. Some of those capabilities are expensive to acquire. Only so many people can have these capabilities. So it does, I think, force a consolidation on the strategic side. And then Tom and I are beneficiaries on the, you know, PE side, as Jeff pointed out, that there's plenty of money out there and the cost of capital is therefore a little bit lower. And there are really good reasons for these independent content companies and commerce companies to consolidate in the face of consolidated customers. If you're a content company, you're selling to Netflix, you're selling to Disney Plus, you're selling to Hulu. Those are big, big, big enterprises. And traditionally, these independent content studios have been relatively small on scale. And so I think that our, and Tom can talk about this too, but our strategy of pulling together must-have content and key verticals that are complementary to each other and going to market in a cohesive, coordinated way at scale really provides a lot of a needed benefit. The benefit of being independent is obvious, but the benefit of being a scaled independent is even better. So we really believe in that. And also my time at TikTok, I'll just say that if you can take the relationship you build with customers and your and fans and extend it into social media and then monetize that with commerce, that's yet another really powerful revenue source. And I think that Hello Sunshine is the first instance of us accessing that. But Tom, I'm sure you want to follow up with something.
Well, I only to say that I obviously agree completely. And I think Jeff's point is well taken. We're at the beginning. But I think the forces that Kevin talked about are pretty powerful. There's continued disruption that we're going to see. And I think that actually leads it naturally to M&A activity as well, as you see new entrants. So Sharon, you asked if we'll run out of companies. You're seeing new folks, whether it's people that are enabling the creator economy, participating in the creator economy. There's new business models evolving for people to participate in it. And I think that that's going to continue to fuel what you've been seeing.
I also think that combinations inevitably yield dispositions. And it's a combination of factors that cause that. Sometimes it's because the combination doesn't work. And sometimes it's because there was always an intention to shed other assets. And there are also a lot of subscale content companies right now that do need M&A in order to be competitive. So I don't see this as it's more of a continuum. There's always peaks and valleys, but there's not ever like a start and an end.
I think we all agree that at a minimum, Pfizer is going to be really, really busy.
And we like that.
Tom, what'd you say? That what?
I said at a minimum, we know Pfizer is going to be really, really busy.
Pfizer's going to be really busy. Well, she's still working with all of these companies. Well, I keep hearing people say things like Viacom CBS has to merge. Sony's definitely going to go. I've heard about, you know, Sony, Lionsgate, I mean, whatever independent. That's not considered. Lionsgate certainly is an independent company, but Sony's, of course, part of a huge conglomerate. I'd like to get your take. Jeff, do you think Viacom CBS has to merge with somebody?
I think they will, whether mm-hmm. they have to. I mean, look, I think one of the big issues, Sharon, is that it is completely unclear what the steady state streaming margin is. You know, we're coming off of a legacy media business where we knew the margins were 40 plus percent, you know, for cable, which was the cable networks, which was the center of this. We have no idea what the steady state streaming margins are. It's certainly not 40%. It may be in the 15 or 20%. Right now it's unknowable because the marketing spend and the program spend is it's a knife fight.
Well, okay, one second. Let's pause there 1 second. So yeah. You've got Netflix has been underwater on spending, you know, on investing for a decade. Kevin, you ought to know whether Disney was maybe underwater is the wrong way to put it, but like, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, they deficit spent for a long time on Netflix to get to where they are. There is a turning point. There is a point at which there's an inflection, and you go from money losing to money making. And by the way, once that spigot gets a little bit titrated, you can make a lot of money. I think there's a huge amount of cash flow that's going to be generated by Netflix in the steady state and by Disney Plus in the steady state, depending on how many subscribers they can get. Jeff's right to point out we don't have any empirical evidence yet as to what the actual margins will ultimately be. I don't think they're going to be cable-like margins, by the way. That ended up being a pretty unsustainable ecosystem. Those margins were pretty high. Maybe some cable networks over-earned for a long period of time, and I think that is coming home to roost now in terms of that bundle becoming. I mean, that was funded. Those margins were funded by enormous payments from pay TV operators to cable networks, which of course flows through to consumers. They have to make money too.
Right.
So that is what that spelled the end of that bundle, ultimately, I think. I think, but consumers, you know, it depends on the service. If you're going to be scaled, if you're going to have 300 million global subscribers like a Netflix has, I don't know how that doesn't engender some pretty substantial margins and cash flow at the end of the day. I think they did become cash positive in the pandemic because their production ended, and this is kind of a glimpse of what's to come. Production was eclipsed, and they had a growth in subscribers. They had a massive amount of cash flow for a brief instant there. Like, I don't know the answer as to where it's going to end up, but of course Disney wouldn't have turned the company upside down and completely without a belief that the margins will be substantial. And we did a comparison. Sorry, go ahead.
But you know, I when a company like AT&T, one of the top 50 companies right. in the entire world, when they don't have the focus and they don't have the cash to compete and they have to offload Time Warner, to Discovery, that tells you a lot. It takes so much focus, so much cash to compete that there's only going to be a couple players that are going to be able to do it on a global scale.
Yeah, it depends on how you define success, but AT&T was highly levered. I don't remember their peak debt load, but it was unbelievably high.
$170 billion, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's kind of hard to, they didn't have money because they were.
I'm going to come back and keep pushing on the Viacom question, but Faiza, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I think, you have to remember that the key thing about successful M&A is that there's a culture component, a business logic component, and then just a vision and execution component. And the ones that work get all three right. And so I think when you look at this media wave, and there are those deals that have worked, Disney Fox has worked phenomenally well. Viacom CBS, there's no question they're better together. Going back a few years, DreamWorks Animation, Comcast, that worked. AT&T Time Warner didn't work, but I don't think it didn't work purely just on, not having the money to fund the production. I think there's the culture component and what it takes to run a creative ecosystem is hard. And the beauty of a Disney is that they have the creative DNA. They've been doing it for generations, but they also understand what it is to be in a relationship with their consumer because of the theme parks business. And you would think that distributors understand that, how to be in a relationship with the customer, but you need both pieces. And it's not as easy as it looks. It looks good on paper, but it doesn't always translate.
Well, that is for sure. And there's a lot of human cost to that never gets discussed at high level business banking conferences. But there are real people who lose jobs and get whipsawed when you have something like AT&T buying Warner and then turning around and offloading it two years later. There's quite a lot of human cost. We see that as a news organization. I want to think about that. All right, let's go back because I think we're talking about what are other companies, if you think that Viacom, CBS, Jeff, or anyone on the panel.
Sure. I think that there are going to be buyers and sellers. We know who the buyers and builders are going to be. They're definitely going to be Apple, Amazon, and Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
Google could do it. But
and Netflix? Do you think Netflix would buy a studio?
Well, they just bought the Ronald, the Dahl library.
The Roald Dahl, yeah, because that's buying content. That's different.
No, but there's no big difference. It's buying IP, that they're gonna use multiple times.
Okay.
But I think you've got, those three. Google, they certainly have the scale to do it. They've got a $20 billion business in YouTube, but they certainly haven't shown the appetite to do it. And then there are the second tier of players, Spotify. We know. Spotify's got a fantastic audio business and a music business. Mm-hmm. We know that they're looking to play in the video business. Is it going to be better to build or to buy? And my guess is that they're going to end up being a buyer. And then you've got, Activision, one of the huge gaming companies. They're already playing in the casual space. They're playing in the esports space. They're $60 billion market cap business. My guess is that they're going to play. As they're going to continue to consolidate and add more services onto their platform. Mm-hmm. So then it comes down to who are the sellers? And I think the sellers are all people that aren't going to have the cash and the focus and are sort of playing, they're playing catch up. One is Lionsgate. They've done a great job with Stars. They're never going to have the balance sheet to compete long term on a global basis. EA. $37 billion business. But again, I think they're going to be, that's bite size for some of these guys. Sony Pictures, their parent corporation, one of the biggest companies in the world. But, in the world of streaming, they're going to get disintermediated in a bundled streaming world. Take-Two, one of the smallest of the console businesses. And then there are question marks, in terms of two big question marks, Discovery, Time Warner, they're going to have $60 billion on their balance sheet when the consolidation's done. Are they going to be one of the survivors? Are they going to be one of the sellers? The same with Comcast, and Universal. and they've had a slow start. My feeling is that, you know, eventually they're going to be sellers.
Comcast and Universal are eventually sellers.
Not Comcast, Universal.
I mean, NBC Universal yeah. is sold, and so is Discovery Time Warner. Discovery other panelists, you agree, disagree? Tom has thrown the eyebrows at you, Jeff.
No. I think that Jeff's looking down the road a piece and projecting a future. A number of those companies, especially when you get to Comcast Universal, they probably will look to combinations. Whether that means selling or whether that means buying is remains to be seen. But I think it points back to your initial question, which is, do we think there's going to continue to be a lot of activity? Clearly, consensus is yeah, there's going to be a lot more.
Okay, so now let's turn to these SPACs. Kevin and Tom, you guys have been making a lot of noise with your some of the deals you've been doing are not under your SPAC, which is just friggin' confusing. Could you guys just stay in one lane, please? And then, of course, Jeff, and in then some ways, you know, Jeff, I will say, is like the father of the SPAC thing. He introduced me to his SPAC well over a decade ago when they were doing the first Flying Eagle, and he took me up in a plane to show me what they were going to be doing in terms of internet and Wi-Fi on planes, and it's been working out. Jeff, I mean, the SPAC phenomenon is interesting. Actually, Jeff, hold that whatever thought you were going to have. I want to go to Kevin and Tom. Let's talk about Hello Sunshine, because a lot of people have said that $900 million reported valuation, some have reported that it was more than that, that you did with Blackstone to buy Reese Witherspoon and Sarah Harden's company. And we adore Reese and Sarah. And Sarah has been at the grill before, incredibly impressive people, both of them on business and creative side. But the people are saying that it was never worth anything like that. What are you talking about? So can you address that?
I'll say one thing.
Kevin, go ahead.
Bulk of this, I think. But we bought Pixar, we vastly overpaid. We bought Marvel, we vastly overpaid.
We being Disney.
Yeah.
But we were there. We were there doing those deals.
Yes.
We were doing the deals. So
yes. Remember the criticism.
I just put a pin in all that criticism. I would argue. We wouldn't do a deal unless we thought it was fairly priced and fairly valued. And you only overpay if you pay more than something's worth under your ownership, and you pay more than you had to pay to get it. And I think neither of those indices were met in this instance. And we're not going to talk about what the price was, but it's not always reported fully accurately. I'll just say that. Love the asset.
Is that inaccurate? You don't have to confirm exactly, but
I'd rather not share and talk about it. But what I would say is that we love the team, we love the strategy. It fits in the viewpoint that we have of how what we want to participate in as a company and as a team, Tom and I, to a T. When we first had our meeting with them, what they wanted to do, what we wanted to do, were like overlapped 100%, and we love what they do. But I mean, Tom, you can talk more about whatever you want to say there, but.
I agree completely. This is a very impressive company and an even more impressive team. We love what they've built. We love even more where they're going to take it from here. And I think those that think we overpaid are actually underestimating what they've built and what they're going to do from here. And we believe in them, and we believe in where it's going to go.
Well, I think what's interesting is we've been talking about what's been in a lot of the news stories are mainly production companies, Imagine Entertainment, LeBron Spring Hill. Although you guys were associated with potentially buying Endeavor Content out of from Endeavor. Is that something that you're looking at?
I mean, we don't want to comment.
Well, we won't comment on anything specific. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, it's just us.
Sorry.
Okay. I mean, apparently Endeavor has to divest itself of Endeavor Content for
WGA reasons. I've heard. That's what I've heard. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's been widely reported. I'm not mistaken about it.
Faiza, what are you seeing in terms of these SPAC deals and these smaller content companies being valued at such a high number and then being driven in potentially to IPOs. BuzzFeed, here's another one, you know, $1 billion valuation. To me, that's like mind-blowing. I think it's, I wish them all the best. I'm a digital media company, but that just seems crazy to me. What's your take on this?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. First, it's just a demonstration of how much content you need in order to have a viable streaming product. And so, you know, one part of that equation is just how much are you willing to spend to originate content. And Netflix, Amazon, I mean, the what they're spending is phenomenal. Disney's spending a phenomenal amount. We talked about Comcast, and so far they don't seem to be wanting to spend that much, but it's not that they can't. It's just that, you know, you can't spend $1 billion or $2 billion on Peacock and expect it to be competitive with Disney Plus. It just won't happen.
Right.
So I think a lot of players are really looking for what are these little pieces of content that I can string together and have a viable service. And that's why they're, you know, it's a great time to be a content producer, and it's a great market to sell into. And I agree with Kevin, something is worth what somebody can do with it in their hands. And that at the end of the day, it's very hard to try to value these things on forward EBITDA multiples or something like that. You just don't know. But if you can string together a viable service by putting a bunch of these things together, and some of it is niche and some of it is targeted to a particular customer, but that's what people are trying to do.
And, well, Hello Sunshine, hang on a second. Hello Sunshine wasn't sold to a streamer. Maybe I would understand that. It was sold to Blackstone and to Tom and Kevin. And of course, Reese is a principal. Is the idea then that you guys are then going to sell it in a few years to a streamer? Is that what we would?
Well, sure. One of the dynamics that we've alluded to throughout this conversation is that there's going to continue to be intense competition amongst the folks who are streaming content. Part of that, they're not going to be able to create everything that they stream inside their own walled gardens. But the fact that many of them have brought their content into their walled garden increases the viability of being an independent player in that ecosystem. And that's one of the things that Kevin, I think, is going to be true. The reason I think that a lot of those companies are looking at things like what Kevin and I are doing is that there's also a benefit to having scale in that activity, so that you've got the capital to invest into owning the content and being able to control your own destiny, have the IP for the long term, and still enjoy the benefit of the huge demand that the streamers have for premium content that helps set them apart. Mm-hmm. And that's driving a lot of.
Yeah, you guys talk about scale when I talk to each of you, and I think that is probably, you know, you have more experience than almost any person who's in the M&A deal making space around what it means to drive scale. Jeff, you have just raised money for another SPAC, and you're not. It sounds like you're not so interested in the content and entertainment space. Is that?
Well, we raised money in March, but we actually already have effected a merger. We merged with a company called Ginkgo Bioworks, which is the worldwide leader in cell engineering. So that went public last Friday.
So congratulations.
We don't have a SPAC. We're going to have to go to Kevin and Tom.
So the whole SPAC.
We can make a deal, Jeff.
We'll have us back soon, I predict. That's an easy prediction.
Yes, I'm guessing. Give them a half hour. They'll have another one.
But Jeff, I mean, but in all seriousness, first of all, congratulations on getting that deal completed. That's amazing. Are you interested in the entertainment media space, or do you think it's too full, but
you know, I think this sort
crowded
of
crowded was the word I was looking for.
Tom sort of alluded to it. You know, you've got all, you know, the shift to streaming. It is an existential crisis for these legacy media companies. They have to save their business. They've got to go direct to the consumer. It takes so much focus and so much capital that they really don't have time for anything else. And so you see all of these higher growth businesses, higher than streaming. You've got sports gambling, iGaming, esports, video games, all of these businesses, social media related, these are the ones that are going IPO or SPAC because the legacy media companies, they just have enough to do. They can't buy these companies, even though they've got a younger demographic and a faster growth rate than streaming. It's incredible. You know, when you look at the under 25, they spend more time on gaming than they do watching television. And as they get older, you're going to see that continue. The business is aging, but these other businesses that are growing very fast, and that's what we're doing. We did obviously DraftKings, Skills. These are both video game and gaming businesses. And those are the companies you're going to see that are going to go directly, direct IPO or IPO through SPACs.
Yeah, we're talking to Strauss Zelnick from Take Two and Phil Spencer from Xbox, and just the numbers from gaming. Also, you're just reminding me that when I talk to you, I feel like I'm in a college course and learning something. Before we have to go, because I know we do have to wrap, Kevin, I really want to get your take on TikTok. That company, I know you were so excited about it in the period of time that you were running it, even though it was brief. And it is one of the few new social media companies to explode into get to scale, to go back to your point. And of course, ran into problems with Trump and China and this and that. What do you think is going to happen to TikTok? People are still using it at scale.
Yeah, it's an amazing, and we've talked about this, Aaron, before. It's an amazing product. It leverages artificial intelligence technology, which is extremely far advanced. And it's the engineering core in China has done an amazing job with it. The business leaders in China have done an amazing job. They're great people. I enjoyed working with them quite a bit. The founder, Yiming, great guy, and a great team. And it did run into this buzzsaw of geopolitical issues, which I don't know that it's, Trump had a certain way of dealing with things, which were, hyperbolic. I think that probably is over with. But if you look at what's happening in China and the degree to which the Chinese government itself is clamping down on youth using mobile devices for gaming, for social media, for social interactions, they want that to end, it seems like. And they put in a time frame. And if you're under 13 or 18, I forget the age limit, you can only spend 3 hours a week on mobile games. That's now a law in China. And that is that's a massive change. And that's coming, that could, propagate throughout all sorts of use patterns in media in China. And so that's happening. There's a lot of things going on in China, which, I don't have much insight into, of course, with the Chinese government. And then, of course, there's still the geopolitical tension between the two systems, the Western system and the Chinese system. And I'm not saying I don't have much insight or commentary about that, except other than to know it exists. And it's a bipartisan issue here, and it exists in Europe. So I don't know what's going to happen. It's kind of too bad if something does happen, because it's such a great product. I use it a lot. I'm imagining it is now becoming used by a broader array of demographics. It's, pretty young, but now it's expanding. Mm-hmm. It's a great product. It's great. I really hope that the tensions such as they are don't end up nullifying such progress in social entertainment. I think it would be a shame, but I don't know the answer.
And you sincerely believe that there are not sort of more sinister forces that could be leveraged because of this advanced technology of TikTok that would make it have downsides to it becoming a major presence.
That I'm very concerned that the Chinese government could see some really interesting dance moves that our youth create over here. So that might be a real problem. Like, I don't know. I'll leave that to experts who look at that.
Well, but it's not insignificant. I mean, here we are, however many decade and a half after Facebook was introduced as a very benign force to connect people. And now all we're talking about is how Facebook is this toxic force that is out of control and needs to be reined in somehow. And they're American. So, this is the unintended consequences that come around from wanting to date somebody or show your dance moves. And so I think it's worth thinking about it,
It is worth thinking about. I don't have any answers for you, but it is being thought about. I know that.
Yeah.
I guess we'll find out how it's dealt with.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're out of time, but I could talk to you guys for hours. Smartest people in the room, in the sector, honestly, Jeff Sagansky, Faiza Said, Tom Staggs, and Kevin Mayer. We will be watching what you're doing very closely. And thank you so much for being here to talk about this era of mergers and SPACs that we're in. Thanks for being at The Grill.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for this week's episode of The Wrap-Up. Thank you to all of our listeners. And remember to follow or subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcast. Be sure to rate and review us and let us know what you think of the pod. And to see and hear more of The Grill, you can sign up for Wrap Pro at thewrap.com/pro. See you next time.